Hello, and welcome to Brannigan's podcast series. Summer is in full bloom, which makes it the perfect time for this four-part installment on Summerfest, the world's largest music festival. I'm Tom Brannigan, CEO of Brannigan, and recently we had the honor of sitting down with two of Summerfest's key leaders to discuss what makes that event tick, career highlights, best practices for bands hoping to get booked at festivals, and fantastic anecdotes that could only come from Vice President of Entertainment Bob Babish and Director of Entertainment Scott Zeal. In episode one, Bob and Scott give us VIP access to the inner workings of Summerfest and background into how each of them charted a path to two of the most coveted jobs in the industry. So buckle up, it's time to rock and roll. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the podcast today. We're joined today by two entertainment industry leaders who many people might not know them. They're looking at me like, you mean us? Yes, I mean you. They might not know their names, but they've really impacted the lives of millions of people working here in Milwaukee at Summerfest. It's no accident that many of the world's most famous recording acts, Paul McCartney, the Rolling Stones, among many others, have performed at Summerfest. Summerfest is, for lack of a better word, an institution in the entertainment industry, thanks in large part to our two guests today, Bob Babish and Scott Zeal. Thanks for joining us today, gentlemen.
Not a problem.
Hey.
So, you two have worked for decades in one of the most coveted jobs in the industry. So, I can throw a rock and hit 50 people who say, I'd love to book bands, right? So, how did each of you get started? Bob, you first.
I was working on the east side with a company. Well, I started out in college working for a company called 1812 Overture Records and Tapes. And I went there. The first day that I was there, they also owned Daydream Productions. There were three people that owned Daydream Productions. It was Alan Dahlberger, Randy McIlrath, and Charlie Fain. And they owned Daydream Productions together, but Alan owned the record store. So I was there at the record store the first or second day that I was there, and I really didn't know what the hell I was doing at the time. And they, at 1812, they had what was called a runner for all their shows, which is the guy that goes backstage, sets up the catering, makes sure the beer's got ice, makes sure if a band needs something, they can get it, things like that.
Sure.
And the guy who drove, who was the runner for their shows, car broke down. So Alan came down to me and said, you know, do you have a car? I said, yeah. He says, well, you're not doing much in a record store here. You want to be a runner for our show tonight? It's sha-na-na. I said, yeah, sure, no problem. I'll go do that. I was studying theater at the time at UWM. So I went out and drove for sha-na-na, did running and all that kind of stuff. And then he said to me the next day, so you weren't starstruck or anything by this? I said, nah, I'm studying theater. I'm interested in the backstage aspect of it anyway. And he goes, how'd you like to keep doing this? The guy wasn't doing a good job, and stay in a record store. I said, sure. So I was doing both.
So how old are you here?
Well, I was in college, so I would have been 21, 22, something like that. Yeah. And so I was working my way up the chain at the record store and working my way in the backstage in the concert business. And I was liking that, and then I was moonlighting for another company in town called the Edgewood Agency, which was starting to do things like, they were doing Broadway shows and middle of the road things like Ferranti and Teicher, these two piano guys, and ballet companies and things like that. And one day, Alan Dahlberger came in and said, we need you more on the record store side, so we're going to take you out of the concert business. And I was just devastated. And I said to Lou Friedman, who ran Edgewood, I said, oh, they're going to take me out of it. I don't know what to do. He said, why don't you come over here and work full-time? So I went over there full-time for the concert side of it. And a couple years later, I got a call from a guy named Joel Gast, who was the entertainment director here at Summerfest. And he said, we're all moving to Chicago to start Chicago Fest, the entire staff. And there's a new CEO here named Jim Butler, and we can't find anybody that'll do the booking, but you know how to do booking. Do you want the job? I'll set it up for you so you could have an interview with Butler if you want. And I said, yeah, sure, I'll check it out. So that would have been in 76. And I walked into the Summerfest office and I sat down behind a desk. Butler's assistant sat me down behind a desk. He walked in. He said, Joel Gast said you can do the job. Threw a one-year contract in front of me. He said, sign this tomorrow. You get the job. If not, you don't get it.
Wow.
And that was my interview. And I've been here ever since. So.
Wow.
I've been here since 76.
And that was nice. So almost 50 years you've been doing this.
46? 47?
46 years.
Something like that? Yeah. So it was. It's my whole life's been here pretty much, right? But it was an interesting interview. And yeah.
All right. Scott.
I met Bob through Vic Thomas. Vic is the associate entertainment director. I moved to Milwaukee, tried finding a job in the music industry. I jumped around with radio sales and newspaper sales, but then I was moonlighting with doing stuff for the Whammies and was working with local musicians, one the guys that had a record company. And so one day I was literally ironing my white shirt to go to my corporate-y job, and I unplugged the iron and I said, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm gonna find my way in the music business. That night, I had a couple of drinks and ran into Vic Thomas, who I knew through the Whammies. And he's like, yeah, man, you're kind of getting a shine on what's going on. I said, well, I just quit my job, and I just gave my television set to my roommate as rent, and I just want to be in the business. And he's like, well, it's kind of funny. We just let go the person who was doing contracts in our production office. Why don't you come down and interview with Bob? I was like, great. Next week, I go down, walk into Bob's office, sit on his couch, introduce myself. It turns out that I grew up in Manitowoc. Bob grew up in Sheboygan. We started talking about the community. We talked about golf. We talked about fishing. We started talking music. The phone rang, and Bob's like, important call. Got to take this. So he takes the call.
Just right in front of you.
Just right in front of me. Like, cool. And then Vic comes in, and he's like, come on, let's go. I just got to take this in. And then on Monday, I got a phone call. He's like, well, when do you want to start? And I said, Vic, I didn't know that was really an interview. That was awesome. So we just hit it off, and I started doing seasonal work for Bob for quite some time. I had my own company. I was kind of consulting, but have been involved with the organization since 1992, and here we are.
So, Bob, what was your first impression of Scott?
You know, I do interviews a strange way that most people do. I want to get to know how the person goes through an everyday situation with me, you know, and I want to talk to him about things that he likes, things that I like, and I can feel if the person's being honest or being real or just laying a bunch of crap on you, you know. So, I already knew what he could do because Vic and I talked about what he's got, right? And the rest of it was just, how do we interact? How do we have for a relationship, and how is this going to work? Because the music business is a little different. It's relationship driven. I mean, there's no doubt about it, and We get along well that way because he knows agents, I know agents, he's got relationships with people, I've got relationships with people, and our office is kind of an open door situation where we're more than checking in on somebody, we're kind of yelling with each other over walls because we want to keep track who's right. Working with what. And we learned this once. The best example of this was two guys named Fred Bolander Dan Weiner. We went into their office, and they were two of the biggest agents in the country. And their office was fairly decent size, but their desks were pointing right at each other, like with maybe 5 feet in between them or 4 feet between them. So they heard what everybody was doing at any given time and could hear what their assistants were doing. And that's the way to do the business, you know. And we decided that worked best for us because there's a lot of pressure. Sometimes we yell a little bit, but that's okay, you know, and throw a phone every now and then. But that that way to do business seems to work best for us in our side of it.
So thinking back to 1976 and where Summerfest has just elevated since then. I mean, you were here, and Scott, you were here for most of this time too. I think about all the people who start out in this industry and don't make it. Either they switch careers or they're asked to leave because they're not getting it done. And you've kind of set up my question beautifully, Bob. What do you, you know, can you summarize in a couple bullet points, what are the two or three things it takes to make it in this job?
Tenacity and honesty. There's plenty of people out there that you run into that aren't honest. And you sift those out right away and decide you're not going to deal with them anymore. And that happens, I think, on a level way beyond us, even with the national agencies, the CAAs of the world, and everybody else. I mean, we make deals. We make million-dollar deals, and we're confirmed on a virtual handshake, if you will. We don't have a contract. We put those shows on sale before we even see a contract.
Do you think you're unique in that way?
No. Our business is unique in that way. And it's shocking sometimes when new people come and work with you, and maybe new accounting people or legal people, they go, "You what?" And I said, "That's not just us."
Right.
An agent calls up and says, calls 32 people and says, "We're on. Tour's going to be announced. You're ready to go."
Okay.
We may not see a we don't pay a deposit till we see a contract. And that's kind of a new thing that we do. And that's when we finally see a contract.
How new is that?
Deposit. I don't know, what, 5 years?
Scott, tenacity, honesty, what do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, both of those words, starting with honesty, is that you are a trusted partner with a band, a musician, an artist, and an agent. So you have to kind of prove to them that you're going to work harder than anybody else, you're going to be more creative than anybody else, and you're always going to be honest. And like, things get messed up in the business, there's conflict, there's change, but you always have to it's not fun sometimes,
right,
as we had to do yesterday, calling up somebody and saying, "Hey, this is kind of messed up. You kind of have to work with us." But because of the relationships that you build and the honesty side of it, that, that is a lasting thing that kind of sets you apart.
Mm-hmm.
And then the tenacity, Bob gets bored by hearing me say this all the time. But one of the biggest things that I've learned from Bob, and it drives me crazy sometimes because he's my boss, and he'll come in and he's like, "What happened? Why didn't we get this band? Was it money or this or that? Or no, go back and check. No, don't give up. We got to have these guys. Or how can we figure out how to make this work?" So the tenacity side of things, I think, in a way that you are, it's sales in some ways, but it's understanding who you're trying to buy the band from and not giving up and showing them the level of enthusiasm that you have and that you really want them to play the event. And maybe it's not going to happen the first year, maybe it's the second year, the third year, but eventually, he's got some great stories about you try for umpteen years, and then because of your tenacity and persistence, when the opportunity comes and some agent has an opportunity, they go, "Oh, I'm gonna call Babish."
Yeah. The Stones happen like that. Exactly how that happened.
I want to ask you a little later about a few of shows and kind of how they came together, but I want to, you kind of triggered another question when you're talking about honesty and tenacity. It seems like, and I think from the outside looking in, your jobs are extremely glamorous. I mean, you get to book these big bands. They're not all huge bands, but a lot of them are big bands. They come in and you're the broker for these, but it seems to me that there's a lot of nuance involved in this, in the relationship building. And you talk about tenacity, Scott. You just said you're on the phone off and on for 15 years. This is not a job where there's a book that'll tell you how to do it. A lot of it is just, what are you made of from an integrity perspective?
Right, and that comes across. That's how the relationships happen. If you think back, good one for you. Remember the stories about the brown M&Ms?
Sure.
And that was done by Van Halen.
Van Halen.
And they did that because they were sending out concert riders, and there were promoters saying, yeah, we're going to take care of it. And then never read the contract riders. And they get to the city and they go, "Well, this isn't the kind of PA we needed, or this isn't the kind of lighting system we needed. This is not what we said we had in our rider. Oh, missed it." So they put the brown M&Ms in. And the reason they did that, they wanted to see how many people actually read the rider.
Right.
When it got down right down to it. And those are the people they wanted to work with. They were sifting out the people that they couldn't trust, So there's something to be said about that.
And knowing what, Scott and I have talked about this too, in the past, knowing when to push and when not to push and when to back off. And there is a sixth sense, I think, you develop in this industry for that. And I think today, especially youngsters who are graduating from college, young professionals who are graduating, they're used to a world where I memorize a lot of stuff, I get tested on it, and I go. But it's a lot more complicated than that, a lot more nuanced than that. You mentioned riders. Are performer riders today, are they pretty similar? Are there any, like, what's the most unique thing you've seen in a rider?
Well, they're not near as wild as they used to be. I mean, in the past, you'd have 5-page wine lists that you'd have in there and say, pick, you know, 4 bottles from each list, or some country guy would want a case of Jack Daniels. I mean, we don't give a case of Jack Daniels out in a season anymore. Those days are kind of gone. It's all macrobiotic. It's real silverware, real, you know, cloth napkins and everything, because there's 100 people on the road. And if people start getting sick, then you have issues, because now then it gets expensive to have a spot where everybody has to sit for 3, 4, 5 days while people are getting healthy.
Sure.
So it's changed. The business is, it's not the Wild West like it used to be. It truly was the Wild West in the early days.
I will say that I was quite disappointed when, after getting maybe 10 years into my career with Bob, that he called up and he said, well, why don't you go? We've got a, I think it was Aerosmith show, right? And like thinking, all right, man, this is gonna be fun behind the scenes, see all the craziness. And I spent more time buying organic beets and food at outposts, because all these guys were kind of phasing out of their wild drinking drugs right. days, and they were going into kind of that new phase. So it's, yeah, it has changed.
You know, it's interesting. People think that we meet the stars. Maybe the stars. I bet you I've met, out of all the acts I work, if I met 25% of the people that we booked, I'd be surprised.
Is it that you aren't allowed to meet them, or your job is so busy you're running back and forth?
You know, if it gets there, if it's available and somebody says the band wants to say hello, maybe, but we don't go out of our way to do that. We get to know the tour managers, we get to know the tour accountants, we get to know the managers. Those are the people that we have to impress. Because those are the people that I may not even have this act the next time around, but they're going to say, those guys did a really good job to put that show on, and I'll work with them again.
So what I'm hearing, this is strategic relationship building. I think people on the outside that look in and they say, well, you know, or think that you know all these stars, but it's actually more beneficial to you for you to know the people that these acts rely on to make decisions on their behalf.
It's the tour managers and the managers that are still in the business by the time they're 50 years old or 60 years old. Those are the guys. Those are the real professionals. And you see the same tour managers every year. They're with a different band, but they're here with somebody else. I mean, there's guys that take care of divas, like Marty Hahn. You see Marty, every time there's a diva here, Marty's the tour manager because he knows how to deal with them. You're showing pictures of your kids to each other. I mean, it's like, it's so old home week when you meet those guys, and you want to help them, and you want them to be successful, and then they, in turn, will help tours go in your direction.
So when considering, Scott, a question for you, when considering people in your line of work, what are the biggest mistakes people make?
Bob's comment earlier, just not being who you really are. I mean, and also just trying to pretend that you have either more experience or you know more than you really do. I mean, we've had, I'm very proud, and I know Bob is too, that we could sit here and talk about probably 50 people that you've mentored through time, that have worked under you, that have gone on to be, you know, tour managers for massive acts, and managers and agents and people who are like big deals in the music business. But I can also think about some of the kids who have worked for us and out of high school, in the college, where they had the potential, but they just tried to pretend that they just weren't honest with us all the time, or they tried to, you know, like, be something that they're not really, that they aren't who they are, you know. So it's like, I just think you, like, if you, you know, in this business, and this kind of goes back to, like, maybe a conversation about, like, when somebody says, how do you get in the music business? It's like, just you work any job that has anything to do with the music business. You're not going to make any money. You intern. You just have to put yourself into this world. And then you have to, you know, be honest. You have to show up on time. You have to work harder than anybody else. So it's like those are the things that we look for. And just like, if you don't know the answer to something, or if you haven't done something before, just tell us the truth, and then say you want to learn how to do it, and versus trying to be somebody that you're not.
Right. We tell the new kids, it's a job, it's a business, it's an industry, it's a profession, and it's not a party. So if I see you bringing your friends backstage to hang out, or sneaking them beers, or putting them in a place they should be so they can see the show or have a little party, I know that doesn't work. You want to go party when we're closed. Go party wherever you want. Just here, when you're here, you're totally professional. It's a business. You don't have hangers on.
Would you say that's a misconception about your job? Like, what are the big misconceptions?
That's one of the big ones, that we're backstage having a party all night long. You know, it certainly isn't that. We don't get to see all the major stars we book. We don't get to see their shows. We see two, three songs, and then we're off doing something else. There's a fire somewhere, or we have to do a settlement with somebody, because it is a lot of money. You know, it's a big business.
What do you mean by a settlement?
Well, you settle with especially in an amphitheater show, those are all hard ticket shows, which means they're guarantees versus a percentage. And it's a guarantee versus a percentage after expenses. So once the show gets going, maybe 3-4 songs into the headliner, you sit backstage with the tour account and your account, and you go over all the expenses that you had, and they have to be verified expenses that you're going to show the band.
Is that a real-time printout?
It happens at the middle of the show. We're printing out stagehand bills and catering bills and advertising, and everything gets laid out, and it's an ad pad for the advertising side of it. And then you sit down with the tour manager, and he goes over everything, and he looks at all those expenses. You take those expenses off the guarantee, and then that's where the split is. And what happens when I say it's a guarantee against a percentage, the band's usually making 85 to 95% of the money after the expenses, right? And the guarantee is maybe 75% of what sellout is. Mm-hmm. So you don't make a lot of money in that middle. It's a little difficult to make it, but you make your money on the ancillaries. You make your money on when a crowd comes in, on everything from ticketing fees to food and beverage and everything else. But you have to settle with the band every night, and we do that. We get our bills and we settle every night at shows. Now, the rest of the grounds are a little different, because the rest of the grounds are what we call flat deals, where you're paying a flat fee to the artist.
To get access to multiple stages.
Right, but you still have to, you have to settle with them, because they may want cash, or they may want something else. And the deal may change for whatever reason, where they decide that they needed more lighting equipment, you get it for them. So you bring them the bill and say, here's the bill, now you pay us for that.
So what the insight here is, there's an element of reconciliation from an accounting perspective.
Absolutely.
There's a finance skill that you're developing too in this job.
Right. It's a business model, and you have to figure out show by show how you're going to break even at least, or make a profit on it. And with the band, when you do the original deal with an agent, you can touch on this, I'm sure, Scott, that you're going with them and you're discussing ticket prices, because you're discussing what the guarantee and what the ticket prices are. And then we have to sit down and decide, can we get out of this show? Mm-hmm. And that means, can we get out of a show? If it's a country show or a hard rock show, we know we're going to sell more beverage than we normally would if it's a kiddie show, right? So you have to weigh all those things out before you decide what you want to pay the artist, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and what I've learned from Bob over time, and sometimes you have to break the mold, because the cost of some of the biggest names in the music business are millions and millions of dollars, is Bob's philosophy is always make the show as affordable as possible, right? So you're, you know, it's like, with a big amphitheater, holds 23,000 seats. How can you present a spectrum of, you know, selling tickets to people who are willing to pay a little bit more money for the premium seats, but making sure that you have a broad spectrum so everybody, no one's going to get cost out. And and in some ways, like, you may, let's say, you know, on paper, it might be like, well, it looks like the gross is going to be less because the ticket prices are lower. But in essence, you're opening it up to a larger audience, that's you're going to sell more tickets. Sure. For that reason. And we struggle because now it's like, I mean, somebody says, here's the price. It's a big number to hit. So it's like, how high can you go? How many people will buy some of the higher tickets? How can we still keep this affordable?
I still remember that. We'll go back to the Stones for a second. I remember when we priced it all out and said, okay, we're going to have $400 P1s. And we all kind of looked at each other and went, oh, $400 P1s. You know, it's going to be the only non-stadium show they were doing.
Right.
But a $400 ticket was, in those days, 5 years ago, that was like a lot.
Yeah.
But then when it proved that, I mean, they went just like that. They went 25 minutes. The whole place was gone. So
right.
Supply and demand.
So you are the gatekeepers of booking this festival. You have a team. How big is your team?
Five. Five people that book.
Including you?
Yeah.
You and three others?
Six.
Five or six.
Is that enough?
Sure.
Sure.
How often do you meet with them?
We're all together every day.
Okay. So they're all in-house?
Well, Scott and I have one spot. Scott and I, Vic Thomas, and then Whit Laneberg, who does all our contracts, we're in one spot. And then there's two other guys on the other side. But they'll be moving into this building next month. And then we all sit down together twice a week, Tuesdays and Thursdays, all year round.
Got it.
Because we're booking all year round. I mean, we've got, I don't know, what do you think, seven offers for next year for 23?
Got to be working way in advance. Yeah. Everybody's planning their tours early in our.
You know, this year, I mean, if you look at today, we're announcing all our lineups. We just finished the festival 6 months ago because we went in fall the last time. Mm-hmm. And now we're going back into the summer. So it's been a continuous thing. We were putting shows together last year for this summer before the fall festival even happened.
So it's a 360. It's not a seasonal job.
Oh, no.
You're working all year round.
Not all year round.
Thanks for listening to this first episode. Stay tuned for the next three episodes in our Summerfest series with Bob and Scott.